Thank you for listening to the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. If you'd like to join our writing community on Discord and get access to fantasy writing classes and books on Patreon, check the links in the description. And if you don't want to miss any future episodes, be sure to follow or subscribe. And to support the show, leave a quick rating on Spotify or iTunes and share this episode on social media or with anyone who you think may be interested. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the show. Thank you for listening to the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm delighted to be joined by author Gabriella Houston. Gabriella, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, thank you very much for joining me. We briefly met at FantasyCon last year. Put your book here. Second bell.
Enjoying it very much.
And you had another book that came out late last year, wasn't it?
Yes, The Bone Roots. Mm-hmm. So, again, Slavic folklore inspired.
Very good. It's really interesting. Like what I've been enjoying most about the book is the Slavic influence, because it's not something you see a lot, really refreshing. No. And there's a lot to learn from, especially like the folklore, isn't there?
Yes, for sure.
So it seems to be like a massive influence in your writing. So let's start at the beginning. Like, so give us a bit of an idea about you, your upbringing, and like how you got into Slavic folklore and how it's influenced your writing.
So I'm a Slav myself. So I'm Polish. I came to the UK at 19 to study English literature. But yeah, when it comes to Slavic folklore, it's really interesting because obviously, like most children in Poland, like I would read like folkloric stories for children, like little picture books, by English standards, extremely dark picture books about like the ghost of a drowned man that is trying to find a wife by drowning a random village girl. But it's a very sad story. He is not successful in the end. So I remember vividly all those stories from my childhood, but then there is no real in-between space between the picture books and the, you know, books for adults to sort of about explore it in a more kind of technical way. There might be more coming out now, but there certainly were none aware when I was growing up. So I went from those like Slavic picture books to reading about other world mythologies, and you know, like I say world mythologies, mostly focusing on like Greek mythology and Norse mythology, you know, with a smattering of Egyptian and Japanese, Chinese. But you know, by and large, we sort of moved away from the Slavic area. And then as an adult, I came back to Slavic mythology with fresh eyes, and I'm actually really glad for having that comparison, because I think when you read widely and you read about different cultures and different folklores, you know, like you start to glean very different value systems, very different rules to do with community, to do with, you know, relationships, how people viewed their place in the world. And just comparatively, it's just a fascinating thing to see. And you see links now to, even with sort of Christianity in between, you sometimes see kind of leftover traditions in modern day.
Yeah, because I suppose that's what it serves a similar function, like religion would serve, like as a way of trying to explain the workings of the world. Like if you hear or see something weird in the woods and you have no comprehension of what it could be, you've got to try and explain it yourself on a psychological level to try and come to terms with it or come to peace with it, haven't you? So I mean, that's where a lot of these things come from, and it's really interesting to get the Slavic perspective, because like I say, it's not something that gets discussed a lot in Western mainstream fiction. And I've been enjoying Striga in the second bell. So is that I'm guessing they come from
Strigas, yeah. So Strigas in So in the second, but so the bone roots has a lot more different types of Slavic creatures and the different types of Slavic traditions. The
Yeah.
second bell, I drew on that, and I drew on those kind of value systems, but I slightly subverted the mythology. So in most of in Slavic stories, the Striga was just a straightforward monster. Sometimes a Striga was born, a child was born with like two sets of teeth and two hearts, for example. Or it was a curse that was put upon a young girl, usually. I remember reading a version of the story, because in a lot of it's very hard to distinguish which folkloric stories you're reading now have been maybe excessively influenced by the sort of advent of Christianity, and which ones sort of retain some of the old value systems.
Yeah.
But in the Striga story, it's really interesting because in a lot of sort of more modern retellings, Striga is killed. But in the I remember reading this one version where the hero of the story comes in and sort of crawls in her tomb. And the way that he breaks the spell is because he kind of takes onto himself her pain, and he understands her loneliness and her and what she suffered. And sort of that act of empathy and true understanding is what is the thing that breaks the spell, rather than just taking away her resting place.
Yeah, that's really
And so I kind of subverted that a little bit, and used that sort of empathy model in the second bell, because there are sugars and they're feared, but they're not necessarily how people view them.
amazing. That's what I mean. It's just like you've got something that you're familiar with, and then you creatively put that spin on it. Just to find something unique and original. It's great. So tell us about the bone roots then and the kind of things that you find in there.
So the bone roots, like in so the second bell is a story about mothers and daughters, really, whereas the bone roots is very much focused on the two mother protagonists. And the premise of a story is 15 years before the story starts, those two women pluck their baby daughters from the child growing tree of goddess Zemia. And 15 years later, one of the children is missing. It was kidnapped as a baby by the fox thief, the sort of elusive, monstrous sort of being that everybody fears.
Yeah.
And the other child is almost grown. She's 15, and her mother, it lives in constant fear. And then you sort of start to see that the daughter is changing herself. And so and then you have those two mothers sort of brought together, and only one of them can succeed in keeping her child safe, and only one of them knows why. So you have like mystery element, but this is much more steeped in the kind of they live in a world that is sort of infused with all of those different sort of Slavic tales and different Slavic creatures that live alongside us. And I really like that in sort of Slavic mythology and Slavic folklore, this element of respect, that we live alongside the creatures of the spirit world, and we have to follow the rules, and we have to understand the rules, and sort of that is how we can stay safe.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. It's like I'm always interested by the Bigfoot stories, and I particularly love the native perspective because it's been a massive part of their culture for so long, and it's like all about respect, and it's like accepting and trying to understand everything's place in the world.
Yeah.
And it, yeah, when you were talking about that, then like I think the way you're trying to find that sort of understanding, it's storytelling so powerful, isn't it? As a vehicle
It
for
is.
helping people see these
And
things. Yeah.
I think when it comes to, when we're talking about mythologies, and sort of religions, those are, which tend to be very high above us and high above the ordinary people, So you might do something to appease Perun, and you might do, like carry on festivities, in the name of another goddess. But between all of that, there is the space that is close to us, and that space is filled with things we don't understand as well. And so what I love about folklore is this concept of, like, mundane, the mundane is not mundane, like that there is so much to be found, and there's so much richness in the details. And that, you can have a banyak, and you can have a creature that his only role is to live in a bathhouse, and, like, he will, like, for a crust of bread, he'll keep your bath warm, and, like, keep rats away or whatever. So, and then you have creatures that are completely separate from us, and they don't care one way or another about us. And that, to me, is very beautiful as well, because this idea that there is a world beyond us. I think a lot of religions, sort of the Abrahamic religions for certain, sort of seem to strip that away, this idea that there is a world that is of value beyond humans. And what I love about folklore is this sort of focus on, like, well, we are just living here. We're just, like, taking this small part of the world. And when we go into the part that does not belong to us, we need to act accordingly.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Awesome. It's a great way to put it. So, can you give us a bit of an idea of your writing process? Is it like a, do you follow like a bit of a routine when you're writing a novel, or do you sort of see where it goes?
So there's a method to my madness, but it's so the one thing that I think, many writers will surely tell you or have told you already, is that every single person who writes will have a different method, because our brains work in very different ways. The one thing that I really personally benefit from is having writing buddies. So I have two of my best friends live quite close to where I live, and we try to meet up for writing sessions as well. So obviously, sometimes life gets away from us, and I just have to write alone. But it's really nice to sort of meet at the library or at a cafe and just sort of, write together. So that is actually, even though that has nothing to do with craft yet, like, we haven't even got into the craft, but that is so important to me, to have that community. Because, in the kind of, when we take, like, 5 minutes breaks, like, the Pomodoro method, 25 minutes writing, 5 minute break, like, we can still chat through if there's any difficult bits, things you don't understand, or something pops into your head and you can talk it through. And that is so valuable. When it comes to the writing itself, like, I tend to start with a pretty vague concept. Like, sometimes it's, and it can be something that is not, does not sound either original or particularly, groundbreaking at all. It can be, like, with the bone roots, I had this image in my head of a fox next to a childbearing tree. And literally, and, like, I wrote something which was, like, more like a little poem almost. And that was my hook for myself, like a description of my book, right? Like, it actually, the final product was very far away from it, but it got me in that mood, and that's in that space for the atmosphere that the book required. Because every book is different, will have slightly different, atmosphere, it will have different different pacing, different different sort of levels of tension. So that starting point was very tense. I knew that this book would have to have like very high tension built up into it because the mystery and the way I've constructed it is it's quite sort of slow development. So there's things obviously happening in throughout the book, but all the things come to a conclusion at the end because it ha that is that mystery element. So I knew that was going to be the way I was going to construct it from the start. But usually what I do is I just start with a character and like they can be doing something quite mundane or they can be at a time like so in the second bell, we start with a mother that is basically being cast out from her town with her baby. And that is gives both a reader and myself an idea of what this book is. And I follow the character and I'm not a plotter, as they call it. Like I don't plan the whole book ahead of writing it. It sounds insane to me because I don't know the characters yet.
Yeah,
So
it's true, because they shape the story, don't they?
yeah. So, I also know people who will like write a book, like bare bone book, and then just add like a add the missing bits later on. Like I can't really do that. Like, and for example, if I am fixing something really big in the novel, I have to fix it straight away before I move forward. Not proper editing, but like fixing big structural things. If, for example, a king is now a nobleman, I need to do it immediately because that will affect everything going forward. And I'm just like, I have to have that foundation, and then I'm like building on it. So that is my structure, and then the kind of rest of the plot the book reveals to myself about a third of the way in, usually.
Nice. So would you have an idea of the end point for what the character wants to achieve?
So, I mean, what they want to achieve should be pretty clear to everybody straight off, right? And it doesn't have to be very specific in terms of how they want to achieve it, but so in the second bell, we have a mother who lives with her baby, right? And so the main point is like, she wants to keep her baby safe, right? And then 19 years later, Salka grows up and does her own thing. But that is the starting point. And like in the Bone Roots as well, like you have the first scene is one of the mothers, Kada, is bleeding on the ground to give payment to Goddess Zemia for the gift of her daughter. And we get told like she does it every year. And she is following the protocol that she understands. But you understand, like this is a mother that will bleed for her child. And so everything else she does, you already have that in your head that this mother will bleed for her daughter.
It's a very good way to approach it. Is that a sort of thing, device that you use when you come up with any character, like work out what the biggest motivation is?
Of course, like we have to when we're selling the book, we are talking about like the stakes of this and that. But I think a lot of it comes from who characters are. So obviously, different writers will have a different perspective on that, and you have a lot of people who are more, plotters, as we call it. Like, so they plan the whole book ahead, and they're very plot oriented. So, what happens in the book is dictated by the big events that they have planned out. So my books tend to be very intimate and they're very character focused and character led. So it's more about who is this person and what does this person want? And then the kind of that is the driving force behind the plot.
That makes sense to me. I like that approach as well. It just makes sense. But obviously everyone approaches things differently, so whatever works for you.
Yeah, I mean, it might work differently, if you're trying to plan a book, like an epic story of an empire, right? The rise and fall of an empire, then the empire is your main character in many ways. Like you have to plan it in a way that makes sense historically, that makes sense politically, and that is, but that is for a complete, that makes a completely different type of book.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly right there. How do you approach world building and setting creation?
So I am very focused on like trying to access like all the senses as much as possible. So like I said, like my books are very intimate, and so I like to sort of think at all times, what are my characters smelling? What are they touching? What's the texture of the things they're touching? How do things sound under their feet? And sometimes it's, and especially when you're at a point in the plot when you're doing something very big,
Yeah.
so you have a fight scene, right? Or you have like the big showdown where the like political leaders of a community are arguing, whatever. What I find personally very effective is, in terms of building atmosphere, is to suddenly zoom in. And so when you just have dialogue, right? If you don't have a lot of, if you don't weave in description of what's happening, you end up with this, I think someone called it like talking head syndrome, where the readers stops seeing in their head the characters. They start just having this like it's almost like two brains sort of transmitting to each other.
Yeah.
So you have to sometimes sort of zoom in on the small details, so the because the character exists in their own body in the scene as well.
Yeah.
And they are aware of their body, and they're aware of their surroundings. And sometimes bringing attention to that, it really helps to ground the scene.
Yeah. Like sometimes like if you listen to someone talk, you might just get like a scent, like a tingling sensation just off what they say. And like smell, like say senses are so powerful. So it's a really great approach to take just to like
And I think
weave that in with your world building as well.
there's a lot of research behind it as well. That is interesting. So I was at an event with a representative of the Empathy Lab, which is a UK charity and which seeks to promote reading as a method for developing empathy.
Cool.
And there's neurological research that shows that when how empathy works in motion, so in the brain. So if you have two people who are their brains are being scanned at the same time, and one person smells cinnamon and the other person reads the word cinnamon, the same parts of the brain light up. So the person reading the word cinnamon is essentially experiencing cinnamon
Yeah.
in a very real sense, because this is how our brains are processed. So it's and we can build that ability as well through reading, which is
Yeah.
interesting. So the more you read, the more real it all seems.
Nice. There you go. Getting very scientific now.
I love to throw in a little bit of neuroscience in there, why
Definitely,
not?
yeah. I think all that is it. I mean, I love chatting with psychologists and sociologists as well because all these little things help build your understanding of like people, characters, and understand what your readers want and respond to as well. It's really important. There's a lot that goes into
Absolutely.
writing. What question I always like to ask authors when they come on is, what is the biggest challenge that you've encountered in your career, and how did you overcome it?
okay, so the thing that people don't talk about very much is that you, when you're a mid-list offer, so you have the top list offers, right? And then you are a mid-list offer, which is basically everyone else, anyone who is not like, you know, Stephen King or selling in six digits. Is a mid-list offer. And the reason why so many people drop off the edge of the world, as it seems, after having three books published, say, is because it's not guaranteed that you will sell the next project to a publisher. So I you know, so that is really, that was quite difficult, like emotionally, to sort of process that you might not be able to sell all your projects, but rejection is a constant in this industry. And sometimes, you know, like so my children's duology, you know, the Wind Child has sold to Euclid and Euclid Publishing. But before that, I did have a few rejections that were basically like, we love this, but we already have something Slavic on the book, so you don't need, we don't need anymore.
Sometimes it's just timing, isn't it? Things like that. And that all comes down to luck. Just like, yeah, there's a big element of that in.
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, the kind of understanding that, you know, you just have to persevere, and like you can't, you know, you can't control other people, you can't control, you know, how the industry works. You can just, you know, control what you're going to do with it. In beginning of May, I'm going, me and a lot of other authors are launching a Kickstarter, because I do lino cut printing,
Nice.
and a friend of mine asked if she could do a story based on one of my illustrations, about like loosely based off Anansi Smith. And I thought, well, let's think bigger. And I actually know a lot of authors, and so I reached out to, you know, a couple dozen offers, and within like 2 days I had like 20 odd people saying they wanted to be a part of it.
Oh, right.
So we're going to be launching Kickstarter probably in May, maybe early May, for an anthology of fully illustrated anthology of world folklore.
That's gonna be amazing.
So yeah, but it's like, you know, it's, I'm in the era of making my own opportunities as well, because traditional publishing works really slowly. I know more and more authors who are, you could say, well established. They have quite a few books out there, and they are experimenting with sort of hybrid publishing as well. So they're experimenting with self-publishing, because, you know, maybe they write more than one book a year, and publishing doesn't seem to be able to absorb that. You know, if you sell a book, it will come out in 2 years. So there is a space in between where, you know, you want to, and when you're establishing an audience, people are expecting yearly turnout of something at least, right? So
I honestly think it's a good the best way to go is to try and do hybrid, because you get the best of both worlds. Then you get a bit of the support and the more structured marketing and the network that comes with like the traditional side. And then at the end of the day, it's the readers that keep you in a job. And if
I
you
mean,
can connect with
it's,
them and
yeah, it all depends on the individual, I would say, because
yeah.
it's not suited for everybody, and it's very time consuming,
Oh yeah.
and you know, it requires some resources as well,
Definitely.
to, you know, to actually sort of promote successfully, because unless you can churn out books every 2 months, you know, and then you can rely on a massive backlist, it's, you know, you have to be able to promote those books as well. So it's, when people talk about wanting to self-publish, I'm like, that's great. But there are like 4,000 books in the English language that are coming out every day. How are you going to differentiate yourself? Because if, they need to have something in their mind that they're going to do, how they're going to approach it.
Yeah.
So it's like, a lot of people that I know that have been like established in traditional publishing for a while are thinking of going hybrid or have already done so. But I always tell people like marketing and writing are two separate skill sets. So you need to make sure to
Yeah.
develop both.
And before you sink a lot of time into the marketing, this is the problem I've always had, is because I decided early on I wanted to try a bit of a hybrid thing, and then I've just invested a lot of time in marketing. Got this podcast being one thing, and websites another one. Sink loads of time into that. You try different things, like you try social media, that didn't really work. And you've got to see what does work and then make that part of your overall strategy. So that's but it's found the balance between everything, because if you do too much of one thing, then you're not going to do any writing. And that's what your readers want at the end of the day. You can have a mailing list of 10,000 people, but if you're not really producing any written content for them to enjoy.
So absolutely. And I think the when we're talking about challenges in publishing, I think like it was a big challenge for me to realize that, and I am very proactive as a like to begin with, I was always like, publicity meetings, I'm coming prepared. I have like a list of things I could do or whatnot. But I did not anticipate just how many different skill sets I'm required to acquire
Yeah.
alongside being an author. Like I thought that, well, an author writes books and, well, publishers mostly do the
Yeah.
promoting, right? And it is true for the very big authors who, you will see getting posters on the London Underground or whatever. But for most authors, you are required to do a lot of publicity. And then, there's other stuff. Like I did not know that I signed up to be a website coder, but
Yeah.
Google changes its terms and conditions, and suddenly I have to actually engage with what CNAME is,
Oh, yeah.
and Google all that stuff to
Yeah.
actually code in so it works.
That is a pain. I mean, SEO, that's what I do with a day job. So I got quite lucky that I was able to apply to writing stuff.
That's a great skill set to have.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, it's the difference between having a website that gets 1,000 visitors a year and 150,000 visitors a year. So you can tie that in with your email lists and all things like that to help promote your
Can I
writing.
interview you next?
Yeah.
Because you have all kinds of skill sets that are extremely useful.
It's just the marketing side, and it's something that has taken a very, very long time to get your head around. Like, email marketing took years to sort that out. And these are the challenges that you're up against, aren't you? And there's only so many hours in the day. So
Yes.
what can you do? Just stop sleeping. It
Yes.
is tough.
It's and it's like that with everything, especially with social media. Like I saw two different videos today on Reels, like one woman doing like DIY around her house. And it looks fantastic. And I feel like I bet I could do that if I had,
Yeah.
I don't know, 5 months free and like a lot of heavy machinery that I could just easily access. But realistically, that is not high on my priority list. And then, like, there is a man who cooks the most delightful meals. Each one takes like 6 hours. And you feel like, well, that looks great, but it's not even like a skill set, it's just time. Like we are all sure so short on time.
I know, and I did a survey recently, which is just looking at challenges that writers are facing. Because I was pretty convinced that AI was going to have more of an impact But surprisingly, I think it was like 70% of people said that AI hadn't really impacted them. But one thing that did and does and still is the cost of living crisis, because now people are having to work two jobs, maybe three jobs, you never know, just to like keep up. And I mean, I work two jobs basically. So it's just the more you have to work, the less writing time you get. It's
I
like
think
writing
that
time
feels
is the
huge, yeah.
luxury. It's like a
But
measure of how good your life is how much writing time you get.
mean, publishing has a huge accessibility issue.
Yeah, this is the problem. This is the massive problem. And I mean, I was saying to you before that I didn't really like FantasyCon last time around, and it's because when I was I'm from a very working class background. I was raised by a single mother. We didn't have anything, you know what I mean? So I'm going to FantasyCon, grammar schools, private schools, everything like that.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? It's just it's not they're not the voices that I can relate to, if you get me. And I think
Yes,
that's a
for
problem.
sure. And it's nice that when people actually talk about it a bit more. I interviewed this children's author, Emma Finlayson Palmer, who also runs the Twitter event, UK Teen Chat, and she always sort of emphasizes that she's a working class author. And I think it's really nice to have that representation because I think a lot of people feel like they just can't access it. And I mean, from practical reasons, it might be very difficult to access it. But yeah, I mean, the publishing itself, when you look at the people who work in publishing and, I remember I spoke to this bookseller once, and she sort of worked with a lot of publishing people, and she said that Forgettable Katies and Vanishing Amandas, she called them. It's like basically all those random young women, usually, upper middle class white women who get random jobs in different publishing houses, and then you find out that they're all like the niece of so and so or the cousin of so and so. So there's actually like a lot of nepotism in publishing. Yeah. So when we're talking representation and all sort of ways that can work, it's quite difficult because the publishing jobs themselves, they pay so little. Until you're like the director or whatever, they pay so little that only people who are already quite wealthy can afford to do them.
And you've got to somehow survive in expensive places like London.
Yeah, so you have to have like either a partner that supports you, or you have to be, or already have like financial sort of safety net. And it's very difficult to create sort of true diversity and increase the motivation to bring other people in when the people who are themselves producing the work and who are themselves in charge have are not representative of that, and they have, even with the best intentions, and a lot of people in publishing have the best intentions, but they don't understand how a lot of things work. So then you get a lot of tokenism, you get a lot of people who are be very vocal on Twitter, but they like even with the best intentions, they might just not know how to go about helping to promote a wider range of people to sort of tell their stories.
I know. It's a really interesting subject. Like I really like the working class angle, because I think people who come from that background see the world in a very different way. Priorities are different, and the themes are the stories are a lot more interesting. Well, to me, anyways, because that's where I am. But there's an Angry Robot author, brilliant writer as well, one of my favorite writers, Daniel Polansky.
Oh, what? Sorry.
Daniel Polansky. And he wrote a series called Lowtown, which it came out a while ago now. But that was very sort of gritty, urban, love fantasy, and he's from Baltimore, which is very similar to Liverpool, where I'm from. And he's from that sort of similar background, and you sort of get the sense of it in his writing. And I really loved it. So I'm hopefully we'll get him back on the show to talk more about like
Oh,
working class writing. And I
that'd
think
be
that could be
great. I
really
would love
good,
to
yeah.
listen to that, 'cause it's basically, a completely different, like you say, mindset, but like it's not even about mindset. It's about like differences, but it's very, you can empathize with things and try to imagine them, but it's really nice to be able to hear from people who actually lived it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the great thing about podcasts like this is we get to get everyone's perspectives. It's brilliant. Gabriella, thank you very much. It's been a fantastic chat.
Thank you so
Where's
much.
yeah, thank you very much. And where's the best place to look if anyone would like to learn more about you and your writing? And you've got
So,
a podcast as well.
yes, so I have a podcast. I'm on YouTube. So on YouTube, the Gabriella Houston Project, where I interview not just writers, but researchers, people from all walks of life, historians, researchers, doctors, scientists, conservationists, and we talk about how storytelling is an intrinsic part of everyone's life and many, many professions.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of very interesting people talking about their expertise.
Thank you.
And aside from that, you can find me. I'm on all social media pretty much, but I'm also on my website. It's GabriellaHouston.com, and I've been mostly focusing recently on sending newsletters. So I send a monthly newsletter with all the news and events and occasional recipe and whatnot.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that's how people can get in touch.
Brilliant. Oh, Gabrielle, thank you very much again. And thank you everyone at home for listening.